Welcome to this special bonus episode of Tinseltown Tragedies, a compliment to our series dealing with Hollywood's most enduring myths, murders, and scandals. You can hear our regular series episodes and additional uncut interviews from the series at our website at moviegeeksunited.net. If you're ever in the LA area, you absolutely must take in the Dearly Departed bus tour, a feverish, fun, and riveting journey through many of the sites associated with Hollywood's darkest and most spellbinding tragedies. Believe me, once you've gone on this tour, you won't stop talking about it. Today, we're so pleased to welcome the owner of Dearly Departed Tours, Mr. Scott Michaels. He's the foremost expert in Hollywood death, murder, and tragedy. Mr. Michaels also hosts a series of documentaries, which will definitely be of interest to all listeners of this podcast, and they're both available for purchase on Amazon, Dearly Departed, and the newly released Dearly Departed Volume 2. For more information on Mr. Michaels' unique and transfixing line of work, visit DearlyDepartedTours.com.
I want to know how it was that you got started in this very unique line of work. How does that happen?
Well, I just being impractical and saying yes to things that come up. When I was I was around death quite a bit when I was a kid, so I was sort of desensitized to it. I had friends, and I'm not trying to sound, you know, dramatic or anything, but I had people I knew got murdered when I was growing up, and we lived in a place where accidents happened and people were killed in near my house, so due to traffic accidents. So I've been around it, and also being a bit of a loner and sort of thought it would be kind of cool to be in the mortician, but my experience in the funeral business, which was minimal, made me realize that that's really kind of dull. It's not really what I'm interested in. So the celebrity angle is what I went for. And I studied a lot about it. I read about a company out here called Graveline Tours in the 80s, and it sounded like a lot of fun. So my goal was to work for them, and I did. And so just being impractical, really, saying yes to things that I probably should have said no to. But here I am.
Well, tell me, because I know that we're all in some way fascinated by death, because it's the one big kind of unanswerable question we have, fear that we have is death. But what in particular about Hollywood death do people find so fascinating, do you think?
Well, people enjoy stories about how the biggies fall, in a sense like that. And I don't mean sadistic glee, but it's death is sort of the one thing we all have in common. So no matter how rich and famous you are, ultimately you're all going to die. Now, to me, where somebody died is sort of hallowed ground. You know, you can go to many addresses that Frank Sinatra lived in or Humphrey Bogart or whatever, but where they died is where history happened. And I think, to me, that's sort of the wham-pow moment, if you will, is being in the actual location where things happened. And I think that, you know, scandals and deaths and murders have always fascinated people. That's how, you know, the tabloids began back in the 40s, so and probably even the 30s as well. So people have always been fascinated with the private lives of famous people, because I think it brings them closer to the human aspect of things, that, they're represented as inhuman, as stars, literally, in the sky. Not literally, that's a bad analogy, but you know what I'm saying. They're elevated
yeah.
to a degree where they're not supposed to be human, and death brings us all back down to being human.
Absolutely.
Not so philosophical,
you know,
sorry.
No, that's terrific. But, you know, there's something, too, I think about just the area in the entertainment industry and all the very colorful, eccentric people meeting in that one location, people that, like artists, typically they don't really necessarily fit in anywhere else. They kind of feel like outsiders, artists do. Does that kind of lend itself to, because I read a lot about the terrible events that have occurred in just the Laurel Canyon area over the years, and I'm thinking, you know, what exactly is this? Why L.A.? Does it have something to do with the nature of that very community?
Well, I don't think L.A. is that much different from any other city. It's just that ours are famous. You know, it's sort of like when people say, oh, you know, there's so many celebrity Scientologists. Well, it's not disproportionate. It's probably 10%, just as much as any other form of the population. It's just that ours happen to be famous. You know, there are people murdered in every city. There are, celebrities in every, are not in every city, but, you know, humans are. So ours just happen to be famous. That's my take on it. And I think that Laurel gets a bad rep. I'm sort of surprised at the way the tide is turning as far as Laurel Canyon goes. I think Benedict is the one that people should look at, and that's the one that widely gets ignored. And Laurel has always been celebrated in my mind, and I'm sort of surprised that that particular publication is coming out as sort of a Laurel Canyon having a sinister aspect to it. I'll be honest, I have not read the book, but I've read snippets of it, and I have to get into it, but it just sort of surprises me.
It's certainly one of the most influential areas, and especially popular music. And I will say the last trip I took to the area, because I'm actually from Florida, was earlier this year when I took your tour. And Laurel Canyon was actually one of the most beautiful locations that we drove through. And the book was eye-opening. I don't know if it's a conspiracy book, so I have doubts about that kind of thing anyway. I'm not into conspiracies necessarily. But let's get to the figures that we're covering on the series. We've recorded a lot of our Peg Entwistle show, and we have a first draft edit of it. But so we have a lot of her story already. But I did want to ask you, because I read something very interesting on your site, that you contributed to her gravestone. It was unmarked?
That's right, yes. When I lived in England, I pursued all those Peg Entwistle locations. This is back in the mid to late 90s. So I went out to Port Talbot, Wales, to document where her house was. And I went to Richmond, where she grew up, southwest London. So I was really interested in Peg from, you know, early on, probably when I took over the helm of Graveline Tours 20-some years ago. And she was always a real fascination to me. And when I started my website, because I lived in the UK, I had access to those places. And the starting of my website had to do with taking people to where these locations were or are. It's sort of what I do here, except I was doing it, you know, virtually then, before people, you know, a lot of people couldn't travel, and there wasn't a lot of information on the Internet about these people yet. So to me, that was important to see where these events happened, even though it's the minutia as far as she was concerned. Because where she lived in Richmond, you know, London, doesn't really, you know, matter as far as what happened to her. That's what everyone's curious about. The people that what started that was I have a message board on my website, and people, you know, go back and forth with their own about specific people, and it came to our attention that Peg Entwistle was not marked, and she is back in Ohio. And somebody having to do with my website began the campaign to have that done. And via my website, I wouldn't say that I'm responsible for it, but my website was certainly a catalyst for people getting together and raising the money for that.
As far as you can tell, when you give your tours, what's the awareness of Peg Entwistle and the whole phenomenon of someone jumping off the Hollywood sign in the 30s? Is there an awareness that happened? Is that part of the kind of the cultural lore?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, you know, mostly it's that chick that jumped off the Hollywood sign. And everyone knows that story, though not many people know the details of that story, which is, you know, where we come in. That's why we call it the Tragical History Tour. So yeah, they might know about this girl that jumped off the sign. They know nothing about her or her history or, you know, when it happened or anything like that, just that it happened. And also, you know, a throwaway statement that a lot of people will use out here is that, oh, people jump off the Hollywood sign all the time. It happens all the time. And Peg really is the only person that actually is documented to have jumped off the Hollywood sign and killed herself. So she started all this. That was back in 1932, and she started this whole dark side of Hollywood business. That's when she became legendary. And what an ironic way to do it.
Well, you can't even get near the Hollywood sign anymore without breaking the law, can you?
That's correct. But it's not hard to do. You know, as far as you will, they will send helicopters after you, and you will be fined. You know, ask me how I found that out. But to me, it was worth it, and to me, it was actually a write-off as well. So I got to see where Peg was born, and I got to actually touch the letter H where she died, which was kind of, you know, sort of bringing the whole circle, the whole thing full circle.
When you, because it's hard to have perspective when you see the sign from a distance, but when you're standing below it and you look up at the top of that first letter, is it a tremendously great height?
Well, each letter is 50 feet tall, so it's when you're right there, yeah, it's 5 stories tall, and it's significant, and it's pretty rocky terrain as well. It's not just a quick jaunt down the hill. I mean, you're scaling down a rather steep mountain just to get to that little plateau, and you realize that when she climbed up that, you know, electrician's ladder behind the sign, and she saw what she saw, which was, you know, all of Los Angeles, really. It's poignant, you know. I'm not going to say it's not an emotional moment. It's pretty grand when you see what the sign is now and what it stands for now.
The case that really fascinates me most of all in LA history is the Black Dahlia, because it's obvious, just the grisly nature of the murder itself and the fact that it's one of the great unsolved murders in the history of that community. But there are a lot of theories about who perpetrated the crime. Which one do you buy the most?
Oh, to be honest with you, Jamie, I'm not really a Black Dahlia aficionado. I've read a bit about you know, most of the theories, and I know enough about most of them to realize that they're mostly just nonsense. You know, and what I find most unfortunate about the whole case is that it will never, ever be solved. It cannot physically be solved ever because of the documents that have been stolen from her file downtown at the police. The police files are gone. Her autopsy photos her autopsy report is gone. So they can never, ever reopen that case. And it's sort of sad. It's very sad, actually, I think.
I think that's one of the things that draws me to it. Even something like especially something like the Kennedy assassination, but this stuff like the Black Dahlia is the same way with me. It's this nagging need to know the unknowable. That just kills me. You know, because
it's funny, in LA, too, people want to associate themselves with it. I mean, there's some sort of I don't know, cachet to, you know, my father was the Black Dahlia killer. I mean, I knew there was a woman that said it 20 years ago. Her name was Janice Knowlton, and there's this other guy, Steve O'Dell. They both claim their father. It's as if it's some sort of badge of honor. I think it's an L.A. thing, trying to make it about me more than anything else, because I think both of their theories are complete nonsense, truthfully.
Yeah. But there's also John Gilmore's book, and actually when I took your tour, Brian gave it in the day that I took it in January, and we, of course, drove past the Hodel house that looks like Jaws, and he said, you know, the best book on the Black Dahlia, in his opinion, was Severed, the Gilmore book.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that right after he said that, and it is the best book because it really humanizes her, and that's something that gets lost a lot. You don't get a sense of the victims necessarily as people.
Yeah, Gilmore supposedly knew her as well, or at least had met her more than once, I think. And so he has that sort of, I don't know, perspective on it. See, to me, what makes her human, I don't know her as a human being, you know, just by, you know, they dragged her through the mud. I mean, they make this woman, this poor girl, made it sound like she deserved what she got. She was a hooker, and she was this, she was that. The part that really affects me the most is what exactly happened to her. And to know her injuries, and to know how much of it was inflicted before she died is really quite moving and quite, I don't know. It's unspeakable horror. It's like it's our Jack the Ripper. I mean, that's what this is. And to think of what, you know, but Jack the Ripper killed people done What she did was what happened to her was calculated. It was a creation. Somebody did what they did and took a step back and said, what will I do next? Some of that while she was still alive. So I find that really so emotionally moving. That's what does it for me as far as she was concerned. Her as a human being, yeah, I'd like to know more about that too. I would. I'd be very curious. But her as a victim is just, it's unspeakable horror she had to put up with.
Yeah, you can't imagine it. Another person that we're covering is George Reeves. His house was in Benedict Canyon, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, and Benedict, is, as I said, it's got this weird, they say there's this magnetic sort of fault that runs underneath it, and also they, you know, it's well-known fact that a lot of Los Angeles is old Indian territory, American Indian territory. And so for all intents and purposes, it could be an ancient Indian burial ground, and we wouldn't know about that. But all the way up the canyon from the Beverly Hills Hotel all the way up to Mulholland Drive is peppered with sort of fascinating stories of deaths and murders, and those are just the famous ones. Those are the ones where, you know, we know for sure. I'm sure there's lots of interesting things that happen to people that aren't well known. But you've got the Manson murders that happened right there, just a half mile down the road. And across the street from George Reeves and up a little bit further was the J. Sebring house where Paul Byrne and Gene Harlow lived, and he died under mysterious circumstances. And then a little bit further up the road on West Wanda was where Yvette Vickers, that character actress that rotted away in her home, they say, for a year, was right up there. And there was that guy that was killed at a Halloween party, I forget his surname, that was dressed like a police officer that was killed by a real police officer at a Halloween party. And it goes on and on all the way up the canyon. That to me is more interesting than the theory of, you know, the military installation in Laurel Canyon and things like that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. When you think about the George Reeves incident and that whole case, which, you know, a lot of the official story on that is questionable. What fascinates you most about that?
Well, to me, it's the show business connection. You know, if it was just some guy, we wouldn't be that interested. And the fact that Superman himself was stopped by a speeding bullet is pretty fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
but it's the showbiz connection. It's Eddie Mannix. It's George Reeves. It's that whole Hollywood aspect to it. These stories captivated the country when they happened, and they just made that Ben Affleck movie, which I thought was quite good actually, the Hollywood Land movie, despite the fact that Hollywood Land didn't exist at that point. I just find it, there's still a fascination, obviously, about it, and I think it's the show business aspect of it.
Well, I saw an interview. I think I'm sure it was her last interview. His fiance at the time. It was from 1989, and she died just a couple of months later. And that was a fascinating conversation to me because obviously she was in the house when he killed himself, and supposedly, and she said, you know, he wasn't depressed at all. He wasn't the depressed sort, which begs the question that, well, then why the heck would he kill himself if he's not depressed at all?
Does it say, it says self-inflicted. It doesn't say suicide, though, I don't think, does it? On his autopsy report, I'm not sure exactly. I'd have to look. Well, I can look if you want to hang on a second. Okay, death certificate. It just says gunshot wound of head. That's all it says. And if I were to peek at the autopsy report, this file, this file is massive, so it would take me a long time to find.
That would indicate that, he, in physical point, in fact, he did shoot himself, but it was unintentional, wouldn't it?
I don't think they actually, I know that, let's see, victims and friends were downstairs having conversation. Friends mentioned having party. Victim said no. And told them and for them to leave. He wanted to retire. Victim came upstairs to bedroom, evidently undressed, shot self in temple. Friends found him at 1:20 a.m. It doesn't say, you know, whether it was suicide or not. And you know, I mean, not to say, it'd be pretty funny if he was playing around with a gun at nighttime after just telling a bunch of people, you know, to basically get out of his house.
Right.
So, you know, why that would happen, I don't know. And she was, you know, Lemon, she was a bit of a dodgy character, too. Not necessarily a, what was it? Something about the angle that the wall, that it went in, or was it right-handed or left-handed? Boy, I'd have to venture into that file again.
It looks very clean too. If you look at the autopsy photo, a very clean wound.
Yeah, gunshot wound. There was residue or something. Now, I mean, if you got a second, let me read this to you. At approximately 12 a.m., June 16, 1959, decedent retired, leaving two house guests, Leonora Lemon and Robert Condon, to retire to their respective rooms. At approximately 12:05, William Bliss and Carol von Renkel arrived and were admitted by Leonora Lemon. The decedent came down from his upstairs bedroom wearing a bathrobe, upset and irritated by the arrival of the two guests at such a late hour. An argument ensued between the decedent and Mr. Bliss. Mr. Bliss apologized, which calmed the decedent, who later apologized for his conduct. At 1:20 a.m., the decedent excused himself as he was going upstairs to bed. Miss Lemon, at this time, made the statement, "He's going to shoot himself." Shortly, they heard a dresser drawer being opened upstairs, and Miss Lemon commented, "He's getting the gun out now, and he's going to shoot himself." Moments later, a shot was heard, and Miss Lemon asked Mr. Bliss to go upstairs and see what happened. Mr. Bliss entered the upstairs bedroom and observed the decedent lying nude on his back across the bed. There was a large amount of blood on his body and head. He went back downstairs and told the rest of the guests what he had observed. Mr. Bliss then called the LAPD, and on their arrival, took them upstairs to the bedroom. There was a .30-caliber German Luger lying on the floor between the decedent's feet. The bullet had passed through his head and had lodged into the ceiling of the room. The shell casing was found on the bed under the decedent's body. The bathrobe was lying at the foot of the bed. No notes or messages giving reason for his actions were found. Witnesses present stated he was quite despondent about not being able to get the type of acting work that he wanted. The guests were instructed to leave the premises, and the resident was sealed by the coroner's representatives. So it's all very, I mean, there's a lot more detail to it than this, but that's basically the summarization.
We have a weird homicide.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski. Miss Tate, who starred in Valley of the Dolls, was 8 months pregnant and was found in a bikini-type nightgown with a rope around her neck attached to the body of a man.
Two bodies inside, two bodies outside.
Among the other victims were Hollywood hairstylist Jay Sebring and coffee heiress Abigail Folger. Authorities would allow no one in an unofficial capacity inside the posh $200,000 home in the hills overlooking Los Angeles. When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines cut. The bodies had been dead about 12 hours. They were discovered this morning by a maid who ran screaming to neighbors. One officer summed up the murders when he said, "In all my years, I have never seen anything like this before."
I would think, because you have a special tour dedicated specifically for the Tate-LaBianca murders and that whole Manson era, I would think that would probably be the number one crime that most people are most fascinated by in the area when they take your tours.
Sure, I think, well, it's been proven to be, well, it is the Helter Skelter, the novel, the crime, true account of the Manson murders, is the number one true crime book ever written in life. And yeah, it's a continual fascination. If people ask what evil is to define it, you're going to get one, Adolf Hitler, and the next one is always Charles Manson. So I think that Manson himself has become part of pop culture, and these murders are certainly a part of pop culture as well.
I mean, we just saw it with the 45th anniversary, a whole slew of kind of programming and online, this kind of interest that has never gone away. I'm curious to know, you being so intimately ingrained in the LA culture, What can you tell me about how that affected Hollywood at the time of the Tate murder?
Well, they often say that the Manson murders or the Tate murders, Tate LaBianca murders, ended the 60s. In a physical sense, they did, because they happened in 1969. But it affected people's attitudes about personal safety. It affected people's attitudes regarding hippies and youth culture. It was it was a pretty tumultuous time anyway at that point, with civil rights and the women's lib and Vietnam and gay rights, and everything kicked off in 1969. So it is part of all of that kind of counterculture, bad meets good, and also, as I say, personal safety issues. These poor people were just sitting around their houses, and within 30 minutes became some of the most notorious murder victims in history, and you couldn't quite wrap your head around it. And also because it was 4 months before they indicted anyone. So during that period of time, people were scared to death that someone was going to come crawling in their house and murder them while they were sleeping. And it could, because it happened. And I think that fear really affected everyone. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, and when these people became eligible for parole, I was scared to death that Manson was going to come crawling up my window and kill me. That's what they did a really good job convincing people that he was, sort of the boogeyman.
Yeah. What, is there any truth to what I've heard that there was a celebrity hit list, or do you think Manson didn't care necessarily about killing celebrities?
Well, the family were desperate to stay in the news because they Charlie was their cause, and they wanted to stay in the news in any way they could. So these people would say the most insane things. One time they called all the press and said they were going to crawl across the valley. The girls were going to crawl across the San Fernando Valley. So, of course, the press showed up because they always put on a show. The girls always put on a show if they weren't shaving their heads or carving X's into their heads to emulate what Charlie did. And the press showed up, and they started crawling down the city block on a busy street, and they made it about a block, and they gave up. But everybody showed up. And it's the same, that was the other thing they were going to do, was they were going to kill Steve McQueen. They were going to murder Elizabeth Taylor and gouge out her eyes, and Richard Burton. They were going to cut off his penis, and they were going to murder Frank Sinatra and skin him and make purses out of it. I mean, it was just insane, things that they said. So there was a quote-unquote list, but I'm sure it was just something made up to keep them relevant.
Yeah. Well, I know that you have a collection of bricks from her fireplace. Now, did you actually, before they demolished it, did you actually have an opportunity to actually go into that house at all?
No, I saw it, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to have actually laid eyes on it, but no, I'd never been in it myself.
Mm. I heard an interview, and actually you did an episode of the Tate LaBianca podcast or radio show, and I heard that, and you referenced the William Garretson interview, which actually started out good enough, believable enough, and then it went on this completely crazy tangent. But do you think that the kind of the trauma of witnessing that event has done something to his recollection of that event?
Well, it's not a recollection. He's just blatantly making things up anymore. That's what I find so ridiculous is that. He's like pontificating because people will give him an audience because he is who he is, because he was the only one left alive on the property that night. So whatever he says, he was there. He has firsthand knowledge of it. So he can make up all sorts of things, which is exactly what he's doing now. Now, not to discount the fact that this is an 18-year-old kid who was only in Los Angeles for 2 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it was when he was, they broke down the door of his little guest house and grabbed him by the hair and shoved his face into Abigail Folger's cut-out face, saying, you did this, because they assumed he did. Wojciech Frykowski, who'd been stabbed 51 times and he was sitting there with a bashed-in face, they broke the gun on his head because they hit him so hard with it. And this poor kid is being dragged out and shoved into these horrific images, these faces. So that couldn't not have affected him. you know, when he was taken, he was arrested or taken in for questioning, and people were spitting on him because they assumed he had done it. So you can't not be affected by that. But, you know, I think now he lives with the girl that claims to be Sharon's baby that was put in witness protection. I mean, that's just ludicrous.
Yeah.
So, but they give him an audience, and they'll lean on every word because he was there.
What do you think, personally? I mean, obviously, he was of great influence to these kids, and I'm sure they probably wouldn't have done it otherwise. But what do you think Manson's ultimate culpability is in the whole thing?
Well, he, you know, Manson was convicted of murder for two murders, Gary Hinman and Shorty Shea. One took place a few weeks before the Tate-LaBianca murders, and one took place a few weeks after. Manson had a direct hand in those deaths. So now he is also, you know, responsible. I believe it was conspiracy to murder. And Manson, you know, Manson was lazy. Manson wanted to get his own things done for whatever reason, and he convinced a lot of other people to do it for him. So, you know, they say Manson was whomever you wanted him to be, and that's what he was to these people. And you drop acid every single day of your life, you'll start to believe anything. And that's what he did. He took away these runaways and gave them a home, and then things changed. So, you know, as far as being physically responsible for the Tate-LaBianca murders, no, I would not say he is. But, you know, emotionally or mentally responsible, yes.
Is there much support? I mean, I hear whisperings that, you know, there's still Mansonites out there that you know, could be considered part of an ongoing family. Have you ever encountered any kind of pro-Manson people?
Sure, yeah. I mean, make no mistake, the Manson family has grown over the years and continues to. It has an online community, and it does not show any sign of dwindling. I mean, people really rally behind him. They say he was framed. And in essence, you know, Helter Skelter is a work of fiction in the sense that, you know, the murders actually happen, but the actual Helter Skelter method of, you know, the blacks and the whites and the war and Armageddon, I mean, those things happen in conversation, but they weren't really the motive for these murders. You know, it was just drugs, really. That's all it was. But they've made Manson into this Christ-like figure. The family did too, and he made sure of it. You know, he'd drop acid, and then he'd you know, put himself on a cross in front of a fire, and you know, these people swore to God that they saw flames coming out of his eyes and his fingertips. I mean, they were, you know, he was a pretty compelling individual. So he convinced these people to do these things for him, and that way he didn't take responsibility for it. But people do come out in defense of him. And there isn't, you know, certainly an online community, and I mean, I get people in my store all the time that come in, and for the reason that they know that I'm involved in the Manson world or in the Tate-LaBianca world on a very minor level, just because I did a documentary about them. But they'll try to dazzle me with, oh yeah, I talked to Charlie the other day, and I'm like, oh great, you know, what do you want me to say? I mean, I'm not impressed, you know. And Charlie is a 5'2". You know, bully, or what he wants to be a bully, and you know, but he's so compelling that, you know, people will listen.
Well, it's, you know, it's tempting to limit it to he was a product of his time, but I don't necessarily think that that's the case, because I mean, we've seen it time and time again since that people kind of blindly follow a quote unquote leader. And it ends up tragically. It's something in human nature that must be there.
Yeah, I mean, he took in runaways. A lot of them came from broken homes. A lot of them had who doesn't have psychological issues? But Manson found those issues, and he took advantage for his own benefit. So, and people left. I mean, people left the family in droves. They were, you know, people were saying, you know, I showed up for the good stuff. I wanted to have have sex and do drugs and sing, and that was all lovely. And then things changed, and he started getting paranoid and patrolling because he was afraid of being killed by people. So a lot of people went, you know, I didn't sign up for this bit. I'm gone. So something within those people, you know, had they decided to stay. So, you know, and communes were not that ridiculous back then. There were communes back then, but Manson just saw something that could he could take advantage of in these poor
right.
people.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, you know, some of them were, but the actual perpetrators have to be, you know, held responsible for their own actions. But, you know, I got to tell you that I went to a lot of these places, both through your tour and on my own, the last trip there. And the one place that really gave me a foreboding feeling, it gave me the creeps, was driving past the La Bianca house. And, you know, I don't quite know why. Maybe it was the time of day. It was dusk, and it just had this terrible feeling. But you doing this for a living and visiting these places so often, is there any spot that still does that to you?
Occasionally it'll hit me a certain way. Now, the La Bianca house is fascinating because it doesn't look that different than it did back in 69. It's up on a hilltop, so you're at the bottom of the road looking up at this building that we've all seen 1,000 times in photographs and in video. So I don't think that that's crazy at all. I mean, it's sort of like a haunted house in a sense. We're so familiar with it, and to actually sit there and see it. I've been to a lot of murder locations. I've sat in a lot of places where terrible things have happened. Not that long ago, I was actually able to sit in the seat that Jane Mansfield was sitting in when she was killed. And to be there and to see what they saw at that particular moment or the situation that they were in is quite moving. And it didn't feel good. It was it's quite awesome, and I mean that as a form of awe, to be involved or to be that close to where something that tragic happened. The only time I ever got really creeped out was in the Wonderland house. I went up there with one other guy when it was empty, and I sat in the rooms where these you know horrific murders happened, and that one was sort of, you know, I'm ready to get out of here. I did not like being in that place. I did not, you know, there was something about it that made me want to leave.
I can understand that. Yeah, and I did see that video. That was a fascinating video that you did on that. And I also saw it in your Dearly Departed documentary, where you have communicated with present owners of some of these houses where these incidents took place. In general, what do you think their mindset is when they know where they're living, when they know the house they're living in, it was actually the scene of something particularly grisly? Do they put that out of their mind, or is it something that they enjoy the lore of that?
I don't think there's any enjoyment in it. I think there's a practicality in it. They saw a good deal and they went with it. Now, Rudolph Altobelli, he owned the Tate House, and he lived in that house for 20-plus years. And when I interviewed him, he just said, you know, I never had any problem with living there. The problem I had were the people hopping over the fence wanting to see the house. Now, the woman that owns the George Reeves House, I spoke to her more than once, and she's completely polite. But when I asked her if we could possibly get in the house to shoot some video, you know, under no circumstances, she, you know, said no. But she wasn't, you know, nasty about it. So most of the time, I think people have sort of grown to cohabitate with the legends that happened in their own homes. And some people are still working on it. There's a gentleman that visited me really recently in my shop, whose house is on my tour. And a few years ago, not that many years ago, a gentleman by the name of Robert Leash, who was a Hollywood screenwriter, was murdered on a Sunday morning, just quite randomly. Someone walked into his house and killed him. But not only that, I mean, they beheaded him, and they took his head across the back fence and left it in someone's house and murdered that person and took off. And that's on my tour because it's such a spectacular story. And the gentleman who owns that house came in and asked me to remove it from my tour because he's having a problem finding renters. And, you know, so some people have grown to cohabitate with the legends, but some people just haven't yet.
And what's ultra
creepy, the funny thing about the state of California, sorry to keep going.
Go ahead.
In the state of California, you're only you only have to divulge for a period of 3 years if somebody died in your house. So even if it's something like the Manson murders or something like, you know, George Reeves, if it happened more than 3 years ago, no real estate agent is obligated to tell you that. So so it's, you know, I doubt it would be a surprise to many people, but it's possible.
And what's really creepy about that is we drove by that house, and isn't that house, and that house is included in the first Dearly Departed documentary, I believe, that you're talking about, the beheading. It's just a normal looking house in the middle of a normal residential neighborhood.
It's a very nice neighborhood, yeah. And that's that house sold for $850,000, a tiny little two bedroom bungalow with a guest house, over $800,000 after the murders.
I also want to talk a little bit about Dorothy Stratton, because we're doing one show where we're combining Stratton and Rebecca Schaefer and Dominic Dunn. But Stratton is interesting to me because I saw this episode of the E! Hollywood Death Trip that you did, I believe it was last year, where you actually spoke to one of the roommates of Snyder, and she had questions about the whole murder-suicide angle that we've come to accept, which was shocking to me because it seemed so cut and dry. What was your take on what she had to say?
Well, you know, talk about psychologically affected by all this. She was 15 years old when those when Snyder offed Dorothy Stratton and then himself, and she had to go back in that house and sleep in that house that night. So that had to be pretty messed up, and to especially for a 15-year-old to have to endure that. Now, Snyder was terrific to her. You know, as far as she was concerned, Snyder was a nice man. And I'm sure he was to the people that knew him on a peripheral level. And but most of the people that actually knew him knew that he was unbalanced, I think. They just didn't think he'd go to the point that he did. But I was surprised by her. Yeah, as you saw, you know, in that show, Danielle and I were both like gobsmacked by the fact that she was actually defending him and saying that it might have been somebody else. And and that's just again, I don't believe that to be true.
Do you you know, there with a lot of these Hollywood murders, a big myth kind of develops around a lot of them. Are there any and talk of hauntings and all that kind of stuff? Do you buy into any of that?
Yeah, I do believe in the paranormal. I do believe in ghosts. I've seen enough of it to believe in it. But I've also heard enough of it to know that probably 90 to 95% of the stories that are out there are nonsense. You know, there will always be another book or a documentary or a television program about, you know, ghosts of the rich and famous. And they're always writing books about these. I think that's the reason, you know, Dorothy Stratton is still a fascination, because there's always going to be another book about her, and there's always going to be, you know, that woman, you know, that was really a surprise to me that we got that interview for that show, because she'd never spoken to anybody about it before. But there, you know, it's a continual fascination. So it's, I don't know if it's a comfort that these people might be hanging around in the afterlife. You know, it's, I don't know if that's the reason behind it, but it certainly sells papers. And I love a good ghost story. We have our own tour of ghosts and legends of Hollywood, and we repeat the stories about the ghost of Bela Lugosi and the hearse driving down Hollywood Boulevard, and Lon Chaney haunting the bus stop, and, you know, where he used to catch the bus every day. I love those kinds of stories, and I do believe that it exists. I do. But I do believe that a lot of it's been fictionalized.
Well, I think when something so terribly traumatic occurs in a space, that there's bound to be a residue of something that remains.
Yes.
And, you know, when I think of that, I think right away of the Tate House, which someone demolished the old Tate House, and they rebuilt their own kind of cutout mansion there. The owner of that house has never spoken about it at all, has he?
No, Jeff Franklin is his name, and he's never had any issues as far as I know. And some people just aren't in tune with that. Now, there is actually a physical wall from the original Tate House in his house. So one of the original walls from the kitchen of the Tate house has been incorporated into his house, because also in the state of California, if you leave one load-bearing wall up, it counts as a remodel. So even though it was a modest three-bedroom ranch-style house, and it's now a 17,000-square-foot Mediterranean villa, it still only counts as a remodel. But Jeff Franklin has always been, you know, pretty level-headed about it, as far as I know, about living there. But, you know, you were talking about the residue, and because I have a lot of this Sharon's, the Tate House fireplace in my office, and I have several people that take this tour that are a bit, you know, I would say psychic medium, or sensitive, however you want to refer to it, and they go straight for the rocks. They don't know what it is, but they go straight to the rocks and know that there is something to do with that. And then I look around my office. Now, I've got the Tate fireplace. I've got a tile from the pool that Brian Jones drowned in. I have a piece of John Denver's airplane. I have a piece of the Hindenburg. I have Rock Hudson's bed that he died in. I have the suitcase that Jane Mansfield packed the night she was killed. So all of these items have that sort of energy to it, I think, and it's all in this office, which is probably why I'm sick to my stomach all the time. But you know, and I try to maintain them. You know, we try to treat the items with respect, and you know, occasionally we'll throw some sage around just to make sure everybody's content. But I don't doubt that there's energy attached to the locations and to these sort of artifacts that I've collected as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the display, and you just have an astounding assortment of historical memorabilia there, and it's just really valuable history. But I wanted just one more question for you about. I wanted to ask about Dominic Dunn, because you've the thing that I'm curious about is the actions of the actor that was in the house with her. Did he stay in the house as she was being choked to death?
Yeah, Packer was his name, David Packer, I think. And the story goes that that, you know, he and Dominique were rehearsing lines in the living room when Sweeney knocked on the front door, rang the bell, and Dominique had broken up with him, and he was trying to reconcile with her, and she told Packer, you know, stay put inside while she went outside and talked to Sweeney. And nobody really knows except Sweeney what happened outside. But after a little while, Packer got curious enough to look out and saw Sweeney kneeling over Dominique's body in the driveway, and he said to him, I killed my girlfriend. So I don't know how aware he was of exactly what was going on outside. Dominique did tell him, more or less, mind your own business, without, you know, I'm sure she didn't mean it that nastily. But I think she said, you stay here, I'll go out and deal with this. So I think that's what he did. And, you know, so I don't know if it was necessarily negligence on his part, although it's certainly been portrayed that way. And I know I've had people that know him take my tour and said that he's pretty screwed up over the whole thing. So I think there's a survivor's guilt. I mean, Terry Melcher, who lived in the Tate house, you know, if Manson didn't know who Terry Melcher was, Sharon Tate would not be dead right now, possibly. So there is an element of survivor's guilt. I don't think you can hold David Packer accountable for what happened, because she told him to stay inside, and he did, as you know, out of respect for her, did just that. But I think that over the years he's been sort of thrown under the bus.
Yeah, probably so, and I see the survivor's guilt too, and even witnessing the aftermath of some of these crimes. I think it was when the Tate murders happened, they were first identified. But was it Roman's attorney that showed up to identify the bodies first?
Yes, and I think he didn't know who Parent was. And no, it was Gerritsen who thought that Wojciech Fikowski was actually Roman Polanski. Bill Tennant was his name. He's the one that identified the body, since Roman was out of the country.
Mm. And I read something that Peter Bart wrote a few years ago, where he said that essentially he ran into Tennant and he was homeless. I think he's kind of rebounded since. This was, I think, in the late 90s when he wrote this piece. But because I mean, that incident just never left him. How could it?
No, this is the first I've heard of that one, Jamie. I don't know about this at all, and I did not know. I mean, you couldn't not. I've always really wanted to talk to I'd love to talk to the girls. I don't want to talk to Manson because Manson, you know, you just can't trust anything that came out of his mouth. I'd love to talk to the girls, but they'd never want to talk to me about what I'd want to talk about. But I would really like to speak to, if I don't think she's alive anymore, Mrs. Chapman, the maid who actually discovered the bodies. She would be a fascinating person to speak to, just to get her take on it. And even though there's not much left to the imagination, I don't think, there's not much more she could say than has been published, but it would be really interesting to get that perspective on things, since we know it so well from the official perspective. But to get that personal perspective on it would be really interesting.
I think she's passed away, and I think she, right after the murder, she kind of ran off into hiding. The police had to track her down just for questioning, I think I read. Yeah, oh, it's terrible.
I've been trying to find out. I mean, some people say that she died in 76 or 78, so I did a little bit of research, and it didn't happen then. So I don't know what avenue to pursue anymore, but I don't doubt that she's dead now. The other one was not related to what you're talking about, but the woman, Marilyn Monroe's housekeeper, she'd be a fascinating person to speak to, even though she's long gone, Eunice Murray. And we already know that she was a liar and she changed her story all the time, but she would have been really interesting because she was there as sort of a bit player for this whole thing. And it'd be really interesting to get perspective. Here's something weird about the Tate case, because it's so embroiled in pop culture. I got a chance to speak to Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders not that long ago, and because he lived in the house with Terry Melcher before Candace Bergen moved in, and he told me that the house was furnished. You know, Sharon and Roman rented the house furnished. So the same furniture that was in that house had been in the house for years through other tenants. And there was a baby grand piano in the room where Sharon and Jay's bodies were found. And Mark Lindsay told me that he and Terry Melcher composed two Paul Revere and the Raiders songs on that piano. Him or Me and Good Times are both songs that were written on the piano less than 10 feet away from where Sharon Tate was murdered. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. Absolutely. I mean, there's all these stories about, you know, I was supposed to be there that night. And
I collect those, actually. I do.
Yeah. And you say that the only one that was legitimately maybe supposed to be there that night was Robert Evans.
In my opinion, yes. I mean, Roman, as I understand it, as I've read over the years, that Roman asked, you know, Evans to check on him, check on Sharon, because it was going to be a couple of weeks before Roman got home. So, as far as making it about me, which a lot of people did do, I think Evans, you know, phoned her up every day or something, and that night he phoned and she invited him to dinner, according to him. So I think, as far as I'm concerned, he's the only one that legitimately can claim to, but... as you probably know, I mean, you've got Rex Reed, Barbara Parkin, Steve McQueen, Peter Fonda, Lou Gossett. I just heard Salminio the other day. They were all supposed to be at this party, and their car broke down, or they started feeling bad at the last minute and chose to cancel, you know. And it's not that difficult to, you know, Wojciech Borkowski was passed out on the sofa. Abigail Folger was in a nightgown reading a book in bed. You know, Sharon was walking around in a bra and panties. You know, it wasn't a party that night. But I do think that, you know, if anyone was going to be up there, it would have been Evans.
Yeah. And she and Tate even told her sister that she wasn't in the mood for company that night, according to her sister. So, yeah. And also that I had heard that Warren Beatty came close to renting that house before Polanski got a hold of it. But he didn't want to. He would have had to share it with other people that were renting it, and he didn't want to do that. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
I'm not surprised, but I don't. It might have been a conversation, but as I said, it was Mark Lindsay and Terry Melcher, and then Mark Lindsay moved out and Bergen moved in, and Bergen and Melcher moved out and Roman and Sharon did. So I, and Sharon asked if they could sublet it from Candace Bergen. So, you know, maybe there was a time where Beatty maybe had a conversation about it, but I don't think he was supposed to be. I don't think he, it got so far as him, you know, looking at the house and you know, potentially renting it. I think he'd probably been to the house many times at different times at parties, much like a lot of people did on the scene. But seriously, renting the house, I've never heard that before. I'm not saying it's not true, but I've not heard it.
Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA097211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being, as charged in count one of the information.
I mean, the Simpson case, it doesn't get bigger than that. You know, that's like the Princess Diana thing, you know. It just doesn't, that was precedent setting. And the fact that it was such a fascination for so many people. It was a daily soap opera. People were glued to their screens for that. So it's the first time that a murder investigation or a murder trial was presented as entertainment, and therefore it affected a lot more lives than, you know, poor Marilyn or something like that. So, yeah, that became part of everyone's daily lives for a good year.
Well, you were in that area when you were in that area. You were already in L.A. in 94 when that broke, right?
Yes.
Occurred? So that must have been, I cannot imagine the circus atmosphere there at that time.
It was weird. And I remember when it first happened, and I remember reading in the papers that O.J. Simpson's wife was murdered, and it was on the front page. It wasn't a huge article, but it was front page material. And I thought, well, that's sad. That's really terrible. And it wasn't until about a week later, well, it was that chase that really cemented it as far as people's awareness of it. And it just got bigger and bigger from then. So, yeah, I mean, it was a tourism industry. I mean, we did it, of course, when I was with Graveline. We added it to the tour because it's what we do. It's what we've always done. It's just that, you know, the rest of the world sort of jumped on the bandwagon at that point. And at first we were the bad guys or the terrible tacky people, and then, you know, lo and behold. So it was all consuming, and especially here in Los Angeles when it was part of daily life, there were certain areas you could not travel to because of the, you know, Nicole Simpson's house, you couldn't go anywhere near it. You took a different street because of the amount of traffic. They had police posted out there because it was such a nuisance. And same with his house. They were blocking off streets because of O.J. Simpson's house, and everyone wanted to see it. So it became part of life. And the day of the verdict, you know, this was shortly after, not that long year-wise, after the Rodney King thing. And Los Angeles was a ghost town. There was nobody out. People took days off, you know, took the day off because nobody wanted to be on the roads because nobody knew what was going to happen. And it really affected the psychology of the city, definitely.
I swear this is the last question, but I could talk for hours and hours about the stuff, and I know you can too. But where do you fall on the theory that, you know, it's not a popular theory, but the theory that maybe OJ in fact did not do it, but maybe his son might have had some involvement and he was covering for him?
That's a good theory. I don't know if it's true, and I don't know if OJ would. Well, you know, if he was put in prison for that murder, for those murders, maybe we'd know a bit more about it. But since he was acquitted, it's become the source of conspiracy theorists. It's like the Maryland thing. It's like the George Reeves thing. We've had a lot of time to think about it, and because nobody is paying for that, nobody's spending time in prison for that. It leaves a big sort of open wound or just an open end, and people don't like open ends. So I think that the theory of the kid doing it, I'm not going to say it's not possible, but it just doesn't seem probable that it would be anyone else except for him. You know, it just works out too well. You know, he could have easily have made it from point A to point B easily. He had just learned how to use, you know, that particular knife. We know that she was egging him on We know that he had a hair-trigger temper. We know that she was doing Ron Goldman. So, you know, it just, everything was there. And I do believe that the simplest answer is usually the right one.
Right. But I was thinking, because I was watching this documentary on the case, and I was thinking to myself, if it were actually proven, I think he did it as well, but if it were actually proven that he didn't do it, could you imagine how many people would completely lose their minds and question their entire existence if that was actually proven? It would just be mind-boggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.